Yay! Yay! Yay, Matthew Mullenweg. Yay! Yay! Yay!
The Linux Link Tech Show. The Linux Link Tech Show is on. Your link to the latest in GNU Linux and technology. An hour of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter. Free software, free speech, open source, open mics. Live from the Linux Link Tech Show studio, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away. Take it away.
The luck of the Irish on episode 127 here on the Linux Link Tech Show.
Do I have the right show up there?
Yeah, 127.
Am I recording the right show?
Blah.
Yeah. Matthew Mullenweg's Nel Inizio M. file from his recital.
Try that one.
When he was a guest a couple months ago, right?
Yeah.
Speaking of the Irish, why the hell don't we have any listeners on the Frapper map from Ireland? I know we got some listeners in Ireland.
Because they listen to Lug Radio instead of us. Lug Radio.
They like their accents better.
I don't know about that.
What happened last week?
Clusterfuck.
Hey, I'll tell you what happened last week.
On a side note, it's me that's compiling tonight.
Yes. What are you compiling?
Audacity.
Ah. I'll tell you.
At least I'm attempting to. Let's put it that way.
Why didn't you just grab the package?
Because I like doing things the hard way.
There you go. What happened last week? Well, as soon as we started off, Alan turned down the volume. You notice that. Woo! All the way down.
No, I turned it back up again.
What happened last week was about two-thirds of the way. Well, actually, about a third of the way into the show, I forgot to plug my laptop in, and it went power down. So I plugged it back in and came back up, and Audacity was still recording, but I had this weird, funky, flat line. But we have a second and, I believe, a third recording going on. And what happened after that was I eventually stopped the Audacity and started it up again. But we missed like a good chunk of the interview from the WAV file. And when I went and I pulled it all together using what we missed from the MP3, for some reason, now I listened to the AUG, and the first half was pretty good. It was all right. It was a little low. The middle third sounded fine to me. It was louder than the first third. But then when we got to the final third, which is when I pulled back in, it was like almost none. You couldn't hear anything. Is when I listened to the AUG, and I don't know why, for some reason that final third was just so faint. On a positive note, I went in and it took me a damn long time, but I pulled out all those long pauses of dead air.
Yeah, we did have some rather
that sounded good.
Yeah, so I was saying to myself,
but you didn't get rid of like the 15 minutes of crap before we actually connected to it.
No, I kept that in, but I got rid of the pauses in there.
That helped. It made the interview go a lot better.
Yeah, I was like, I don't remember the interview going this smooth because I got rid of the pauses. But and when we did that, I really enjoyed the interview with her. I was like, wow, there was a lot of stuff going on back and forth. I really enjoyed having her on, and I really like an Australian accent.
Yeah, that was nice.
I like
it's easy on the ears.
Yes, and so's British too. I like British too, but. It's like United States English sucks. It's just so brutal. Brutal on the ears. Other things going on this week. I had sent an email to you guys as I was driving home after reading those articles in Linux Journal.
Which articles?
About, the podcatchers and Bash Potter and stuff like that. And one of the complaints I hear over and over again, particularly about Bash Potter, is that you cannot choose what files you want to download.
You can with bpconfig, which I use.
Well, you can do that. Which, as I was driving home the one day, it hit me, and I said, whoa, there's a problem here. Because first, number one, there's two issues.
There is another version out there of Bash Potter. It's one of the user-submitted ones.
Right.
That you can tell it to just, like, download the first one or just do an update and get all the information, but not download the podcasts.
Right, but see, here's the problem. Here's the problem right now. This is when podcatchers first came out, and my understanding of a podcatcher, okay, it's like an RSS aggregator. And all the RSS aggregators that I have ever used go out and pull down all the feeds in the RSS feed that are current, okay? And an RSS feed, if you look at an RSS feed at any given time, you're going to get anywhere from 10, maybe 20 posts in that RSS feed. No more. So my understanding of what a podcatcher was supposed to be was just like an RSS aggregator, in that it goes out, it gets the latest feed in the XML file, pulls it down. All right? Now that is incumbent then upon the RSS generator, the feed podcast feed generator, to make sure that their RSS feed doesn't contain every frickin' show they ever did. All right, that's
And many of them do.
Right, that is not the point of the RSS feed, of the podcast feed. You're not supposed to have every single show. And I think that's a fundamental flaw of people not understanding
how to generate an RSS feed. Out there, and people like Adam Curry, who has got like 300 freaking episodes, you subscribe to him, you're going to get 300 freaking downloads as soon as you set it up.
It's not supposed to be that way. Now, if you go to like something like WordPress, automatically generates an RSS enclosures feed for you. WordPress, you check out the feed, there's only like the last 10 posts. And you can adjust that, you know, under your blog. But see, that's the fundamental problem here. Like a blog or a news site, the RSS, the podcatcher is not there for you to test out a podcast, okay? You go to the podcast site, you pull down an episode, you like it, you subscribe to it. That's the point of a podcatcher. Yeah. Right? Now, Link eloquently added the name for what everybody else wants, seems to want, and that is a pod browser. Okay, now a pod browser would have like iTunes or what is the one, what's the Cast Pod or whatever it is? What's that other one that's
Cast Potter?
Cast Potter.
That's the old iPodder X, isn't it?
Yeah, the one that runs on Linux now, where you can actually go out, look at different shows, you can grab a show, download it, listen to it. All right, a podcatcher is like an aggregator. There should be no reason why you need to choose individual shows. You're supposed to run it in the background. That's what I think, and I think that's the problem. There's podcatchers, there's pod browsers, and people who generate and create the RSS feed, you're not supposed to have every single show. All right, that's obnoxious.
It's a waste of broadband.
That's right. It is obnoxious.
Killing everyone's bandwidth.
Damn them. And I know there's a whole lot of front ends and different things to Bashpotter, and they're great, and you can pick and choose what files you want to download. And more power to you, because you can do it. But that's just, that's what I was thinking.
Amarok about. Works with the podcast, too.
I heard of that, but I'm not too keen on Amarok. I'm not too keen on that.
I've never really used it.
I've gotten more into it lately. It's nice in the current KDE.
Let me have a Guinness over there, please. See, what I don't like about... What Amarok is like a little too heavy for me, because when you start up Amarok, it wants to catalog all your music. And I'm not looking for a media client to do that. Because I don't keep my music files on my system, and I generally don't listen to podcasts on my workstation over there. Yes. If I'm going to listen to something, I'm going to listen to it off the stream, the MP3 act or that I have going on. So, you know, that occasion...
But that's you, Dan. A lot of people like GUI clients that have lots of features.
But I like
do everything, you know, under the sun.
I like XMMS. I like VLC. I mean, I'm pretty cool with that. That's... But what's the other one? Is it... No. Like, before my wife's laptop bit the dust, every time you...
No, which one was this? This is Son of Frankenstein? Or is this the 12-inch powerbook?
This is the second head of the two-headed transplant of the Son of Frankenstein.
Oh, okay. Because right. When you were saying that, I was like, oh, did the 12-inch one die? You know, did you got the CD stuck in the one time? Your Apple, did that die? Or was it,
no,
was
no,
that?
That's still... You know what?
The kids are beating the shit out of that.
Somebody chewed through the cord on that. I had to go out to eBay and buy a new cord last night, a power adapter. I could go to Apple's site and buy one for like $80. or I can go to eBay and buy one for $30, or I can buy a knockoff generic one at eBay for $15. So I figured I'll just try that.
It's a piece of shit. Go with the freaking cheapest one.
Yeah, I was looking at buying a new LCD for the gateway. But the problem is, I already replaced the bezel on that with a new LCD and everything. And when I took it apart last night, I couldn't tell if it was actually the LCD or there's something wrong on the motherboard. Because, like, it would work, and then I'd jiggle the keyboard, and it would get messed up. And I'd reseat the keyboard, and it'd be working fine, and you move the screen, and it would get all messed up. So I'm like, well, I could buy a new LCD, but I don't know if that's going to fix it. I already dropped $300 on this.
Get a new computer for $169.
Right. Yeah, I know. That's what I said to her.
The Linspire machine?
Yeah, I said to her, you know, we could buy a damn new computer for the price of the LCD. And I'd rather, you know, instead of dumping more money into that boat anchor. Not to mention the fact I got like 8 laptops laying around this room.
You got to put one of them together.
Yeah, I got. Yeah, I should. I have a Dell that works. Can you believe the way laptops used to be? That's just obnoxious. They're bricks.
I had a Dell. I had an Inspiron 7500. Man, makes a nice boat anchor nowadays.
Oh, they're terrible. Last week, and let me see if I can find this. Amid all the what's wrong with the sound levels, the sound levels sucked emails. Last week we had a.
Well, it's sort of. I was listening in on the stream just now, and I think it sounds better than this tonight. I'm hoping.
I hope and I pray, but today I'm still just a bill.
Sitting here on Capitol Hill.
We also got an email from somebody. They were asking about what distro they should install on a really old machine, like a 300 megahertz machine. I didn't respond. I figured we could talk about it.
Yeah, go ahead. Let me find this email that
I would go with Damn Small, personally. It's nice. It's Debian-based. You can do an apt-get upgrade on your system and keep it running.
Slackware.
It's really light. And it's got a real nice version of Fluxbox running on it.
Blackware.
It's really good for those really old machines.
Let me back up a second before I add my 2 cents and Alan keeps interrupting with Slackware all the time. last week I had...
I got to do the work of Link tonight, so...
I had issued a request or suggestion from people out there regarding a cross-platform video streaming solution. And explaining that at work, we have a daily show that they do in the middle school, and one of the problems that we're having is it's getting it so it'll run on all platforms properly, because it's they want to do a better feed, but they're kind of stuck with having to do QuickTime movie. He'd like to do MPEG-4, but the MPEG-4 doesn't really play right under Windows Media Player, and you have to have the latest QuickTime, and I'm not even sure that's supported yet on Windows. So somebody, Jimmy Cho, had written to us and said, what about a Flash player, converting it into a Flash video and playing it using a Flash player? And let me drop the link in there that he sent us. And I got to say, the next day I went to work armed with one of those videos, which I actually pulled down on my machine at home and ran it through FFmpeg, like he gave us in here in his email. It's just basically FFmpeg. The input file was whatever file. The output file was the video name .flv, and it converted into a Flash video. And using the Flash player, which was really simple to set up, it worked, and it worked beautifully. It was a fantastic job. There's only one problem, though. And that is setting it up so that I don't have to administer this thing and convert these videos every single time, because there's not an easy way, unless we pay a couple $100 to get some software, for them to pull the video in and have it automatically converted into a Flash format. Now, I could do it with a script, but I'm concerned that if I wrote a script to do it, they might not be patient enough and think that it's not working right for it to be converted. Plus, they have
click,
to
click, click. It's not working. Click,
yeah,
click, click.
It's not working. So that worked. Well, that worked really great. I'm trying to figure out a way that we can kind of integrate this. But yeah, video codecs do. It is really this suckwad world out there right now. We kind of have a little bit of a compromise now. I set it up so that it plays using an embedded QuickTime player, and it seems to work. It is pulling it out of straight through HTTP, so it works in Windows. I don't know, I think it does. I didn't really test it because I don't use Windows. It works in OS X, and it works on Linux. If you're using, you know,
of course it works on Linux.
So, the Linux, that's all I cared about. I came home, I tried it out, I'm like, woo, it works on Linux. That's good enough for me. It's got to work everywhere else, right? Anyway, back to the other question.
Lightweight distro.
The lightweight distro, and that was by MSI Undergrounds. He says, I've been listening to your show for a few months. It's great. I have a question, though. My friend has a 300 megahertz computer. He refuses to upgrade, and he's running Windows, and it's dirt slow. What's the best distribution he can run to speed things up? He's never ran Linux before, though.
Vector's supposedly pretty good, too. I haven't tried Peanut. Have you guys tried Peanut Linux?
I haven't used that in a while.
Vector was what we had you guys had written that kids stuff with.
Right.
And that was really nice.
That was with, what, Ice Windmaker?
Back in the day, yeah.
Well, but that ran on, like, you know, P100s without any problem at all.
Yeah. See, here's my opinion on that. Any distribution that you go out and get, any modern distribution, except for kind of the niche distributions like Damn Small Linux, Peanut Linux, but most of the ones that people are familiar with are going to be a little top-heavy for that. And I'm not going to say you can't run those on there, but you're going to have to spend a significant amount of time modifying it and tweaking it so that it runs a whole lot faster.
Damn Small is great out of the box.
Right. I think Damn Small would be the best option. That's what I was thinking. What I'm thinking is if you go with like SUSE or if you go with Fedora or Ubuntu, it's going to be really top heavy at the front. You're going to have to really tweak it. You're going to have to whittle it down. You might not want to choose KDE or GNOME.
The problem with those distros is they start up every freaking service underneath the sun when they start up.
Right. So you're going to have to really, like I said, whittle that down. And again, one of the caveats here is this guy's never used Linux before, so it's going to be coming from a brand new.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Yeah, so
otherwise, if somebody knew what they were doing, I'd say run Arch Linux, man, and put Fluxbox or XFCE on it or something.
Right, and that's what makes something like Slackware or Arch or even Debian itself kind of like right on the edge because, again, it's someone who's never run it before. Is this person going to want to invest the time to learn something, or are they going to want something that's easy to use and administer, like using Yast or Red Hat's tools or Mandrake's tools? But then again, that comes with a price. It's going to be top heavy or Ubuntu, you know, GNOME or KDE.
I don't think for what he has, I don't think he can run KDE or GNOME, either one of them.
I think you can. It might be a little slow, but again, you're going to have to really strip stuff out of there. And
maybe he drops like a gig of memory in there with a 300 megahertz machine.
Right. So, again, I agree with Pat. I think Damn Small Linux might be the best way to go.
It's a nice version of Fluxbox. Like, personally, Fluxbox is, you know, most people see Fluxbox and are familiar with Linux and they're like, what the hell is that? But the Fluxbox that comes with Damn Small Linux is real nice, man. It's really customized. It's really tweaked out. It looks fantastic.
And there's a script that'll install it right to the hard drive, isn't it?
Yes, and it's app-gettable. So once it's set up and running.
App-gettable.
Yes. You can do app-gettable.
That's a new word, right?
App-gettable. Once it's set up, you can upgrade it.
Pat,
very
you're so
easily.
App-gettable.
Just don't do app-get KDE, I guess. That would be the best choice.
No, you'll be waiting a while.
But yeah, Damn Small, I think, is probably the best thing to start off. I think, you know, I'd love to suggest Slackware, but then again, like I say, if this guy's new and he might be a little hesitant about running Linux, Slackware, while it's great.
Yeah, it may be a little bit.
You're
going
to end up having to spend a lot of time, you know, over there helping him out.
Have you guys seen Vector lately, Vector Linux?
I haven't used Vector in a while.
Yeah,
I hear it's really good.
I tried it a while back. It's nice. There is some tweaking that you got to do to it. When I tested it out, it wasn't a complete install. There was, you know, a few spots where you had to go in and fill in the gaps with some tweaking. But right. It looked real nice, though.
Yeah, but, you know, it's Slackware, Vector, Arch, Debian, those are also, you know, prime choices for being able to get a slim desktop on there.
But you got
to
know what you're doing.
Right.
On a side, Dan, the pictures of the clean room are on the flash
yes,
card.
Yes, Dan
there.
Cleaned up this room. It looks fantastic. Good job, Dan.
What's going on?
You can actually tell there are two desks and a table in here.
Yes. You got rid of all this crap piled up.
Figured it's time to get rid of that shit.
Thank God.
Take it all out.
And I also see you're running the new version of Dynabolica over here for the stream. Looks good, man.
It is. I like, figured, new room.
That's Fluxbox right there, right? That's a nice version of Fluxbox.
No, that's Windowmaker.
Oh, is it?
Yes. Windowmaker. Whatever happened to Windowmaker? I run it at work. Speaking of running stuff at work, I did the install of the Novell Enterprise Linux.
How'd it go?
And by and large, it went fairly well. One of the problems I'm having, and I'm not sure why, I think I know why, is trying to set it up so that you can log into Linux and it authenticates through eDirectory, and it requires doing it through LDAP, and I'm struggling with getting that to work properly. I'm not sure why. It's not as easy as they made it look. It amazes me. SUSE, while it's a nice distribution, I think tends to be one of the slower distributions out there. Because some things I do for administration on this thing are damn small Linux, but this is damn slow Linux for some reason. That's the only thing I don't like about SUSE for me, compared to like Arch or the other distributions I run quite frequently. It is significantly slower. There's a little bit of pokiness. But it's a really nice distribution. They do a good job. Now this machine I'm running it on, it's got a Xeon processor in it, and I'm trying to think of whether it's close to, it's somewhere around a gig, and it's got a gig of RAM, and it's...
That should fly, man.
Well, it's not.
A little top-heavy, is it?
For sure, yeah. And quite frankly, the other machine, there's another machine that I run that has Slackware on it that's running the exact same architecture, and that sucker flies. And we run a lot of different services off of that, like a streaming server and a mail server and an IRC and a web server. And it flies. And I don't have any of the issues there, but I don't know.
What are you going to do?
It's
either you go with it or you run something else. That's all.
And now, I do like it.
Techie wants to know, what distro are we running? I'm running Debian on my blog server. Ubuntu with KDE, not Kubuntu, Ubuntu with KDE on my laptop, and Arch Linux on my main workstation. Dan?
I got Slackware on my server. I got Arch on my music server. I got Arch on my main workstation. I got Ubuntu on my PPC.
And we got CentOS for the Asterisk Box.
CentOS for the Asterisk Box. The wife's running Ubuntu. I have a Slackware server at work, Slackware workstation at work, Slackware backup server at work, SUSE Enterprise Linux server at work. And
Alan, what are you running?
That's it.
Slackware.
And OS 10.
And OS 10, yes.
Link is running everything pretty much. He's big into Slackware. He's got some BSD boxes running. He's also got Debian running, I think, Ubuntu.
And Link's on the chat, so he can answer that.
Link wants to see the pictures of the clean room.
Oh, yeah, I got to upload them. I'll be doing that in just a minute because I gotta squeeze cheese over there. What else am I gonna add? Oh, I'm running Dynabolic too, obviously. And the laptops over here all have Slackware on them. My laptops. What are you pointing at your crotch for?
Clock.
Oh.
Where the hell do you I'm tapping my watch. Where the hell do you get crotch out of that
watch? Your watch is down there by your crotch.
I'm holding it up in front of your face. And my crotch isn't in front of your face.
Guys, what the hell's going on here? Put your pants back on, Dan.
You know what? There was something I wanted to do before I went to get the pictures.
It's all that Mexican beer you're drinking.
I'm going between Irish and Mexican beers tonight. I'm mixing.
It's the same colors, man. Actually, the Irish flag's got orange in it. Mexico flag's got red in it.
La, 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 la. Novell with their XGL.
Speaking of which, did you guys download Carrara? The guy on the DistroWatch podcast mentioned it. I tried it out. It's okay. I mean, it runs great. You know, you just pop it in there and start it up, and it starts up. If you have like a fairly new NVIDIA card or ATR card, and it works great, but, you know, how much of wobbly Windows in...
Carrara?
Carrara.
Is that that... Is it a live version?
Yeah, it's alive. It's based on Gen 2. Some Australian guy put it together.
Alive.
Speaking of live discs and all that crap, I threw out a ton of
old install CDs.
Of discs.
Me too, man. CDs. I cleaned out all my old crap.
I had like all these floppy discs, and I just like took the big thing, and I'm like, yeah, I just dumped it right in the garbage.
I was like, yeah, I came across, I was cleaning the other day, I came across some like stuff from like Windows 3.1. I'm like, yeah, I'm really going to use this anytime
soon. Oh, speaking of that, look over there on top of the scanner. Are there two floppy disks right there? One says Linux file permissions writing. Presentation.
There you go.
Pop that into the floppy drive right there. Go ahead, put that in there.
For this one here?
Yep.
This computer?
No, the next one.
I have to find floppy.
You
got to
find the floppy drive.
Floppy drive? I don't know what those are.
Is it spinning?
Little green light's on, so I'm assuming that, yes.
All right. It's interesting, because this file, this if really, I'm not
this
mistaken...
This really is all your porn, right?
No, if I'm not mistaken, this...
It's porn from the sneaker net days.
This floppy disk is a presentation that was put together by our wonderful Lincoln Fezzedin way back when the lug
back
started.
In the day.
And what's interesting
and we actually did presentations at it.
Yep, is that he did it, and all the files end in .htm. Wonder what he was using to create that
front page.
And I see a picture. I see a file in here called preview.wmf. WMF.
Didn't he take some pictures of his workstation back then?
You remember that? WMF. I thought that was pretty interesting. Yep. All right. We got a guest tonight. Pat.
Before we get to the guest, Alan, what do you think of the Stogie, man? Pretty good, right?
Yeah, not too bad.
Yeah, it's nice. Macanudo's good, man.
It's not a Nat Sherman, though.
I like Macanudo's.
Are we good?
Yeah, let's do it, man.
Actually, Romeo and Julieta Havanas are really nice, too. It's a little hard to get around here, though.
Yeah, you ever had Partagas, man? Those are pretty good, man. That's hardcore, though.
Okay, no, I haven't had one of those.
My grandfather used to smoke those.
Okay. All right. Let me entertain you with our guest tonight. When we bring Rick on, let me actually
all the,
tell
all
him.
The Queen references tonight.
Let me entertain you. Do 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 do. Oh man, what was his name? Ugly Rock or Rock Ugly?
Ugly Rock. The
A-Team. That's not the A-Team.
Indiana Jones?
Yep.
Yeah.
I hope that's right. I hope we got it. I'm going to give him a second or two so he's ready. He should probably be hearing this by now. Link's been sick an awful lot these days.
He's got the head, man.
Or he's just too lazy to come in. He doesn't want to ride with you, Pat. I think he's dissing you.
He's elite, man. He's being really elite.
Did you guys go?
He got mentioned. What it is, man, he got mentioned like 3-4 times this past month in the magazines, and it's gone straight to his head.
That's it. I'm too good for you guys. Did you guys go out to the Trenton Computer Fest?
Not Trenton, no. This is
next month, though.
No? That's Cherryville we went to.
Oh.
It's a ham fest. Which wasn't too bad. There wasn't very many people there. Picked up a little LCD 20x16 display. got to figure out exactly what I want to do with it now, but for $20, I couldn't go wrong. And Wink picked up one. He bought a fire extinguisher as well.
does come in handy if someone's breaking into your house and you want to bash your skull in.
Oh, yeah. This is like this 10-pound ABC, I think it is.
If you don't feel like taking out your AK, you know, just want to hit him with a blunt object.
Well, all right. With all his computers, all it's right, probably good gonna, to have gonna, one around.
We're going to bring this guy in. And, oh, by the way, with Skype, the newer versions of Skype, you know how Link's always saying, whoa, it never happens with Slackware. If you run Skype, the newer versions of Skype, since I transfers from Ubuntu and then over to Arch, the newer versions of Skype hog the DSP device and will have that error that if you try and make a call after you make the initial one,
it won't hang
up. It doesn't let go of the device properly. There is a fix for that, and there's an application called Skype DSP Hijacker, and I'm running that in conjunction with Skype.
What
right
does that
now.
Do? Kill Skype?
It manages the connection to the DSP device so that Skype, it'll release it so Skype doesn't hog it and doesn't think it's busy. It properly releases it. So as you notice right now, I'm going to call Rick, and I didn't have to close out of Skype. I hope it doesn't prove me wrong.
I was going to say, you know it's not going to work now because you yeah. talked about it.
All right, so here we go. And when we get him on, when we get Mr. Timmis on, I'm going to upload those pictures. And here we are connecting. It's odd because I'm not used to not hearing a ringtone when you're connecting.
Yeah.
I don't like not having a ringtone.
Hello, Rick speaking.
How you doing, Rick?
Hello, Dan.
Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rick, this is Pat. How are you?
I'm very well, Pat, thank you. How are you?
Excellent.
Pat's going to introduce you to everybody else in the world.
Okay.
We've got Rick Timmis from Adaptive Linux Solutions from the UK. It's the middle of the night. Rick, thank you for taking the time out and staying up with us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. And, very good.
So what exactly is Adaptive Linux Solutions? What do you do?
Okay, we specialize in working with Linux and open source technologies exclusively. And we work with small, medium-sized businesses to help them basically deploy and utilize open source in their business to get the maximum benefit from it. This might involve the traditional things that you would expect to see, deployments of Samba and mail servers. Etc. But also right across through to the desktop as well. So we've done probably at least three or four deployments now with people that have gone directly to the desktop. And we've had a great deal of success with it here in the UK.
Now, is there, I guess my question to you is, what solution do you normally suggest? I guess it's customizable depending upon what the needs of the customer are.
Very much so. I think often tech companies come at the issues that are facing the business community from a technical point of view, and that's the way we see the world. Right. But the reality of it is that the technology is not as important as the business process that's trying to be achieved. Now, that means that the first thing you've got to do in recommending a solution is to actually listen to what the business needs are and the business processes are and be able to identify those. Once you've got that far, then you can start thinking about picking a solution. So we wouldn't necessarily come to a business and say, hey, you should use this distribution and you should use this set of applications. We will have a number of applications that we consider to be enterprise ready from obviously the enormously broad set of applications that are out there in the open source community. We pick from a small percentage of those that do certain things really quite well. And you'll actually find that in 70% of the cases where we're speaking to a small business, the application set that we are picking from will suit that business and be able to deliver a solution for them. The other 30%, that tends to be a situation where we sit back and say, actually, you know, open source or these technologies are perhaps not correct for you right now, and there isn't anything that we know of out there. Yeah.
So is it a matter of people looking just to save money, or are they looking for a better way to do things, more economical? What is the driving factor that companies want to switch to Linux?
Well, I'm not necessarily sure in reality that many companies or business people are actually aware of Linux or what it can actually do for them. I think that's certainly been my experience. I mean, we've been working in this particular sector, and I'll come probably back around to some of the early stuff we did in 2000. But over the last 3 years, my initial findings in the marketplace has been that when I initially started speaking to people about Linux and open source, and those of us that are involved in it, we know a lot about it and we're very much aware of what's available. But the response I was getting back from business was, what do you mean there is something other than Microsoft? I've never seen this. I don't know what you're talking about. So obviously, when you're talking to these people from that point of view, there is no motivation to switch to Linux at all because they don't know about it. So the first thing you need to do is to sit back and say to these people, okay, look, you know, well, initially we're an IT company, and so Adaptive Linux Solutions presents itself very much like that. We come at the whole concept of it just like any other IT company would. We sit and listen to the business process. And then we say, okay, here are some solutions that you could use. Now, when you then start to put a Linux and open source solution on the table, then initially people start to say, well, hang on, if I've never heard of this, why would I want to use it? And you need then to be able to present some salient benefits and to be able to say to the business, okay, this is what Linux and open source has to offer. So the initial message that you find yourself getting involved in probably, well, certainly for the first year that we were out there in the marketplace, was literally just educating the market to actually say to business, hey, this stuff is available. It has a strong pedigree. It is secure and reliable and has a whole bunch of benefits that may well really, really work very well for your business.
In my workplace, Rick, one of the obstacles, one of the arguments I hear from people is, what happens when something goes wrong and we need to sue somebody? Who do we sue? Have you heard similar arguments from other people?
Well, not necessarily quite so dramatic as that. Forgive me for being kind of typically British, but American.
We Americans are sue happy. We love to sue the shit out of each other.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a very litigious society that you have over there. So, but this is the question of, okay, who do I turn to if I have a problem with this? What happens if Adaptive aren't around anymore? Who's going to support this for me? And, hey, if this doesn't work, then, you know, who am I going to bring to task over this? Well, you know, Let's deal with the point of who are you going to bring to task over it. Do you know, the technology has only a limited impact in those terms, because what's actually happening between the two businesses is you're entering into a contract, either verbal or written, that says we're going to do XYZ and give your business certain functionality. And you either deliver upon that or you don't. Now, the technology is kind of immaterial there. If you're not going to deliver that solution to the client, then either you don't fully understand the technology and therefore can't apply yourself to deploy it appropriately, or alternatively haven't spent enough time with the client to really understand their business process. So you can't tackle it from that point of view. So that's the first thing to get out of the way, is that the technology is not, for me, and certainly I believe, not coming into question here. This is about taking a professional attitude and a professional approach to dealing with your clients. Now, when you then start asking the question about support, sure, there is the preconception, if you like, that your IT support company, if they go out of business, who's going to help us with this? Now, if you're talking about a proprietary solution, say a financial and an accounting package of some description, to which you don't have access to any of the code or access to anything except the binaries, and that company goes out of business, and you have no documentation, well, you don't actually need to even be in a position where that solution stops working for you. The very fact that the majority of your corporate data is now locked up in this solution and your supplier is now out of business means that how are you going to get access to that? You know, how's that information stored? And it's not the software itself that is the asset. In businesses, there's this concept being bandied around at the moment of software asset management. Well, it's not the software that's really the asset. It is the information, the business information and the data that the business has that is the tangible asset. Now, if that's locked up in a proprietary vendor's protocols and data structures and so on and so forth, then your organization could find itself in real trouble. So you can start to then lend some weight to this argument by saying, okay, this is a key benefit of open source because you obviously have access to the source code. It's totally available to you. You might not necessarily understand it, but there are plenty of technically able and competent people in the world that can understand it. And that doesn't necessarily mean that support has to come from the open source community. You know, much of this work is developed in standardized languages that professional people know and understand. And furthermore, the open source development model tends to use standard open formats for storing data. So once again, you can get access to this, and that allows you to interrogate your data. So I'm not convinced, and certainly when I discuss this with my clients, I'm not convinced that the argument withstands of what am I going to do. Now, to add some more credence to that, there are other organizations where I suppose individual businesses might collaborate together, and we have an organization like this in the UK called the Open Source Consortium. Now, the Open Source Consortium has got about 100 members and associates, of which there are about 80 active either individuals, partnerships or limited companies that are working throughout the UK to deliver open source solutions to people, sometimes based on BSD, based on Linux, whatever. And part of the code of conduct for members joining that is that the members of the Open Source Consortium would support other members and will make the Open Source Consortium known to their clients and customers. So this starts to create a comfort zone, if you like, where I can stand in front of my clients for our company and say, you know, if in 2 years' time Adaptive aren't around, then, you know, you have access to the Open Source Consortium. Here's another 60 or 70 companies that understand this technology and can take this on and support you. So you're really dealing with that issue that you pointed out there in kind of four separate ways. That's how we handle that here.
So what resistance have you had, if any, I mean, from businesses around there? Or have you actually had a lot of success?
I think the IT industry in any area is a very competitive marketplace to be in. And as I pointed out earlier on, one of the first things that we came up against was this, if you like, trying to breach the beachhead initially, which was that people don't know anything about this technology, and as far as they're concerned, people buy what they know and what they understand, and that is predominantly a Microsoft-based solution, because obviously wherever your PC vendors and so on and so forth, everything that you see is supplied and running on the Microsoft Windows platform. So the first thing you've got to do is educate the market and explain to them that there are some alternatives out there. And then once you reach that far, then you start looking at the resistance issues like the one we just discussed of support. The other one that comes to play is, of course, many, many organizations already feel locked into their applications and their application set. And so the first question they then ask is, okay, so this is great. This Linux thing sounds really good, and I've taken on board some of the benefits about that. Can I now run my Windows software on it? And you say, actually, no, you can't. And, you know, then you start to get into this situation where the business is feeling locked into a software set that it's already got. So you have to be able to overcome that. And, of course, the way that we normally tackle that is to say, well, look, you know, the very reason why your business is successful and is growing and doing well is because it has to be unique in some or many ways. Because if it was the same as everybody else, it would be the competitive environment would see to it that the business didn't grow and that it shrunk. And this is true of every business. So if this is true of every business, then surely a pre-boxed set of software solutions that you just pull off the shelf and plug into a bunch of computers, drop those into the office, plug them all together and launch and go, is not going to provide the business functionality and the business processes, if you like, that really suit your business. What happens, and we see this time and time again, is that a bunch of software is deployed and the business processes are changed and adapted to suit the software. Now, if you look at that, if you take a step back from that for a moment and just say, okay, let's look at the business sensibilities of that, it doesn't make sense because you're beginning to lose your uniqueness. So we have to look at that business process and say, okay, what you're looking for now is we're talking about flexibility, because your business is going to grow and change. So we might put a solution in now at year one, and you maybe got 4 or 5 users. If your business is successful, and if the process management procedures that we put in place enable that business to grow, in 3 years' time, you might be 20 users. Now, certainly here in the UK, many of the financial packages that we have will probably grow to maybe 6 or 8 users successfully before they really start to struggle. So if this thing won't expand and won't grow with the business, you reach this upgrade point probably at about year 3 as the business grows. So just as the business is starting to take off and move forward and show growth, all of a sudden, we've got to have an infrastructure change. We've got to change our systems. We've got to change our accounting and financial systems. We've got to perform a whole sequence of upgrades. Well, that the net result of that, that's just a total business disruption. So one of the things that open source has to offer is this flexibility, because the initial infrastructure that you're putting in tends to be broader and much more robust, shall we say, because I guess, you know, it started life Linux and much of the open source products and software items that we see, like Apache and Samba and things like this, began life in an internet environment, which is a large scale network. When you transpose that into the small business and start putting that kind of infrastructure, you're putting some heavy duty kit, heavy duty software solutions with a fine pedigree in at the base level. So what happens then is that you're able to begin adapting and manipulating this software as the business grows. What we then see, and certainly we've seen this over our 5 years' experience, is that what goes in at ground zero and begins to grow and is developed upon, that base infrastructure often stays there, and we're just using the open source nature to be able to manipulate and adjust the technology as the business process grows. Now, once you start to be able to present those arguments to the business and to sit down and say, you know, this is where it's going to be in 5 years and in 8 years, and this is how it's going to grow, then all of a sudden this state starts to make a lot more sense. When you then say, and on top of that, once we've deployed this for you and you've had your initial costs at day one, nobody's going to come back and start knocking on your door in 2 years' time, 3 years' time, saying, hey, it's time to upgrade all your hardware. Hey, it's time to upgrade all your software. You know, you should be talking to us about volume licenses and and all of these additional costs, those cost burdens aren't seen to the business. And once you're able to present that particular element to them, and the business user understands this, then the resistance, you find that the resistance fades very quickly.
So where do you, if you don't come back with that, where do you make the money?
Okay. Well, this is about, it's about taking a different approach, you know. If you go back to pre 1980, before the idea of packaged software and cheap licenses were about, what was actually happening in the software industry was that you had some base products, some base functionality products. There were a lot of people out there that were developing software, writing code, creating specific pieces of software to suit specific businesses. And you're actually moving back to that model. We've been running in this model for 10 or 15 years that what we need to do is to turn everything into white goods, put boxes on the shelves with manuals in them, discs, and sell those out, you know, by the dozen, pile them high, and sell them out there to everybody and get everybody running the same thing. Sure, this is a model to generate revenue, but I think that experience has shown that it's a model that doesn't create satisfied customers and doesn't produce an appropriate result. Where the real value is, that's where we've got to get to answer this question. The real value is actually in the fit between the software solutions that you're providing and the business process. This now is a service that you're providing. It becomes a knowledge-based service. And that's where the value is being able to come back to the customer and sit down and say, okay, we've put XYZ in here for you, and this is now moving forward. Let's do what every other professional business does. And they get back in touch with the customer in 3 months, in 6 months, and say, hey, how's everything going? Is everything working well for you? Is there anything else that I can help you with? Go back and see the customer, talk to them again. What happens is that if you've got clients that have got reliable solutions in place, so they're not fighting with viruses and spyware and bits falling off the network and all this kind of issue and problem that often many businesses see today, if they're actually moving smoothly forward, you'll find that they'll have a whole bunch of ideas, and they'll say, do you know, if we could get this information out of our database and report it like this, that would save us 4, 6, 8 man hours a week. If we could introduce a method of linking the email into our customer database so that we had some sort of relationship management solution, we could better service our customers. Is that something that you can do? Sure it is. So we're able to then come back to the bar and implement these improvements and implement and move the business forward. And of course, there's a value in there. The great point about this is that the customer doesn't see this now as, oh, it's another license fee, or, oh no, more IT support because it's gone wrong again. They see this as a business improvement. They see it as value. And so they actually welcome this in the business because it's going to make things better for them. It's going to make them more efficient. And that ultimately hits straight on the bottom line. And any salient business person is looking at the bottom line.
Okay, so One thing, I want to step back for a second, and one of the things that was brought up is tech support, or Pat had mentioned, you know, who do I sue if something goes wrong? My question for you, being you running your own business and you having to answer these issues about tech support, really, tech support, is it really that much of a big deal? I mean, when you get down to the nuts and bolts of it, because I know my experience with tech support has been you ship enough money to a company and they'll give you enough support, they'll either say, well, you know, we're just going to replace your hardware, or we're going to work with our back-end team and hopefully find a fix for you. And, you know, a couple months later, you either got the fix or you moved on to something else.
Um, I'm not entirely sure that I'm clear on the question, but I'm so I'm going to try to answer it in kind of in our approach.
That was
sorry. Go ahead.
That was a piss poor question. That was more of a complaint than a question. But what I'm saying is, I know people make a big deal about tech support, but when you get really down to it, in your opinion, is the tech support that you get from going with a Microsoft solution any better than the kind of tech support that you get with any Linux solution, or if you even rolled your own Linux solution and went out on the forums, in your opinion?
Sure. Okay. Well, in fact, I think the answer to that is, in my opinion, I want to answer this question in two ways, actually, that I think might put a little bit more clarity to it. To answer it directly, I think the net answer is that being able to have the ability to find the information and find appropriate information and then deliver support based upon that information will always be better than not having access to something and almost being in a position where, I guess it's a little bit like I'm going to use a car analogy here to make this clear in two ways. Okay, if you've got an old car enthusiast and he's driving, say, a Jaguar, for example, and he has an issue at the side of the road, he pops the bonnet, gets inside, has a fiddle around with the engine, eventually manages to fix something. If, however, he's driving the Jaguar, pulls it to the side of the road, and the bonnet's welded shut so he can't get into the engine, now he's got a real problem. How's he going to fix that? So that analogy gives some clarity, really, as to the difference between the two. Now, furthermore, here's an interesting point, okay? And in my mind, I've never been clear quite why this is, but this seems to be the reality. When we go and buy and purchase our computer solutions for our business, we walk into the shop and we're told that we need X, Y, Z and some various bits and pieces of software, and then that we're told that what we actually need is some additional licenses to allow us to use this software. We also need some antivirus software and malware patches and a whole bunch of other stuff to kind of fix the stuff that we're buying and make it work properly and make it work securely and safely. And then we're told that the next best thing for us to do is to begin then some sort of support and maintenance contract that we will pay out for on a monthly basis, so that when the machines break down and fail, somebody can come out to fix them. Now, we don't question this. We go into the shop, we buy our machines, and we say yes and nod our heads politely to the salesman and shell out all the cash and pay for it. Let's take that to a different scenario. So, we go down to the BMW garage to buy ourselves a nice 3 Series or a 5 Series BMW, and we're shown around the car, and we buy it, and then the salesman says, "Now, if you'd just like to sit down with me, we've got a few bits and pieces to go through. What you're actually going to need is some additional engine management solution bits. You're going to need some additional extra functionality before you can drive this car on top of your 30 grand. And once you've finished doing that, then the guy's going to turn around and say, "Now, the next best thing for you to do is to start paying us a monthly fee, because when this machine breaks down, you're going to need somebody to come and fix it." Let me ask you a question. Are you still going to buy the BMW?
Hell no.
Exactly that. So when we start talking about support, it always strikes me as quite bizarre that people are going out there and actually selling support to people. So we take a different approach. What we say is look, if we're going to supply you something that's reliable, flexible, does what it's supposed to do, works in your business and is going to work effectively, I would be being a little bit cack-handed, for want of a better word, to then be trying to sell you support on top of this, because I've just told you on the one hand that it's going to work, and now I'm telling you you need to pay me for when it breaks. This doesn't make sense. So we don't do that. We take the approach of having what we call an open support agreement. So we say to the client, look, your money is better used on developing systems that suit your business, not on supporting poorly implemented systems or poorly put together software. So What we'll do is we'll provide you with these reliable systems that will function for you, and I'll talk about some anecdotal evidence of this in a moment. And these systems will function and do what you want them to do. You save your money. We'll give you this open support agreement. We'll guarantee to have an engineer on site with you within 4 hours if you need one. More importantly, for 98% of the things that you'll ever need, we'll be able to do that directly over the internet in 15 minutes whilst you're on the telephone, whether that's configuration, whatever you need. And we're not going to charge you to give you that support. It's there for you. You can call upon it whenever you like. Whatever we deliver to you, so if you request us to add users or do configurations, or if you had an incident and you needed us to come out and fix that for you, we'll come out and we'll look at it and we'll charge you for the time. So we're going to charge you for the value that we've added to your business. We're not going to charge you for anything else. Now, I mentioned as I was coming to that point some anecdotal evidence. And I was recently going back over our customer catalogue and looking at some of these customers. I mentioned earlier about the way to generate value in this sort of business is to revisit your customers. One of the customers had actually dropped off my target list, and I hadn't spoken to them for the whole of 2005. Now, we'd got this is a fairly substantial implementation, and the majority of the things that we put in hold the whole of that business infrastructure together. There are a few Windows PCs dotted around, but essentially most of our equipment runs the whole business. And initially I thought to myself, I haven't heard from them at all. I did some digging around to see whether any of our engineers had had any support calls or anything like that. Nothing, not a whistle from this client at all. So I tried to phone the client and wasn't able to get through. So I thought, okay, let's just have a look and see whether the system's still there. And I thought to myself, I bet, you know, it's not, and they've probably put an alternate solution in. So I opened up an SSH session, so you know, a secure internet connection to connect to the server, and there was the server. So I logged in and was able to log in, and I thought, great, okay, well, let's just have a look at the uptime and see how long the system's going for. So I typed in uptime, and it came back and told me that the system had been running for 493 days.
Well, one of the things, like, if I talk to an admin, especially a Windows admin, they can't understand, you know, the whole concept that, you know, your Linux box could run for months and years straight without powering down once. They don't get that concept.
Well, I would say fortunate or unfortunate, depending on how you want to view it, to be invited recently to join a Microsoft small business specialist group, one of these small groups, if you like, that of several Microsoft certified gold partners, etc. And speaking to one of these partners today, I was informed that if you speak to Microsoft about server upkeep and managing the servers, they actually specifically suggest that you should reload all of the software onto the server every 12 months. And I have to say, I was completely astonished by that, that this would be the way forward, is to completely reload of the software. But this seems to be the case, and in my experience, and I don't have a huge amount of Microsoft technology experience, I've used it a little bit, but not a great deal. What I tend to see in terms of engineers that I come to see is that the appropriate fix to resolve a solution is to do one of two things. The first thing is to turn it off and turn it on again and see whether that fixes it. If that doesn't fix it, then the next thing to do is to wipe the hard drives, back up the data, reload the operating system, reload the applications, reload the data, and get it running again. And engineers who have joined Adaptive have actually proposed this. You know, they've been sitting in front of a Debian box and they've come and said to me, I can't get it to do something. It won't do this, that, and the other. And think I'm going to reload it. What the hell do you want to do that for? You know, you've already spent an hour and a half doing this. But that's the way that they see the world. And certainly their experience, if you imagine many, many people that have only seen this technology, they've only seen Microsoft technologies, and their experience of this is that's how you deal with it. You reboot the server. There are companies that I've spoken to that I have that I know in the Southwest here, that actually, as part of their policy to support their clients, scheduled Windows NT servers to reboot themselves every day. I'm not entirely sure how you get 5 nines uptime and reliability from a system like that.
Well, that's if you don't count the reboot. You got that.
You got that
15-minute break. Two things there. First off, number one, I listen to what you're saying, and I agree with you 100%, and it drives me crazy, and I want to beat my head against the wall, because what I hear time and time again from these people is, that's the price of doing business. You know? That's the way. That's the way it just is. But now, let me ask you this question. In your opinion, okay, the first response that I get, or and a lot of times I give to people who are running Windows or whatever, and you get from tech support when you're running Windows, is if you're having a problem, did you reboot the machine? Did you reboot the machine? Now, in your opinion, if Linux or any other operating system ever got to the point of having a market share that was significant and comparable to Microsoft's market share, do you think we'd start getting tech support requests that would say, okay, you're having a problem with your Linux box, reboot the machine? Is it just a lazy or a kind of a general response to a problem that's saying, hey, a lot of times there's a good possibility that rebooting the machine might fix the problem. And you know, in the case of Linux, you know, maybe rebooting the machine might fix the problem too, but because we're running Linux and we're pretty familiar with it and more intimate with it, we have a better idea of how to fix it without rebooting.
Okay. Well, first of all, there are different levels of technical support, and you know, the help desk scenario that you talk of initially, which is, hey, you know, did you reboot the PC, is the power plugged in, and so on and so forth, these are standard things, I suppose, that give the user something to do at the other end, and are kind of, they're the initial things that any good engineer would have to do initially to do his diagnostics, especially if you're talking about a system that doesn't give you the kind of fine-grained control that you need to see what's going on. You know, you've got a bunch of menus and a bunch of all sorts of kind of different graphical user environment stuff that's available to you on Windows. But can you really get into the core of that machine and see what it's doing? The answer to that is no, you can't. So because, once again, the bonnet's welded shut, then you start to get stuck. The only thing you can do is open all the doors, close all the windows, get in, get out again, and see whether it starts this time. You are going to get this scenario as a Linux user base grows, where that would be a standard answer for a tech support call. Hey, you know, reboot the machine and start again from the beginning. I don't think it's going to make any difference actually on a Linux, in a Linux box. I think occasionally this is going to cure the problem, but it's not, it's going to fix the problem temporarily for now, but it's not going to get to the root cause and stop it happening again.
All right. That's a fair enough answer. I see what you're saying. And you do make a good point there, because I know it's really frustrating when you try and debug a problem on a, in Windows, you don't have the same feedback that you have in a Linux or an open environment to be able to troubleshoot the problem that much easier.
Absolutely right. I mean, I think that's a key problem. That really is a key problem, is that it becomes very difficult to see what's going on. And so I often wonder whether this is what bridges the resolution in the engineer's mind to just say, hey, look, I'm just going to wipe this disk. I'm going to reload all the software, because that's actually easier, because I can't get any further into this problem. Whereas you don't have that in the open environment, because you can dig into the problem to find out what's going on. And that allows you to fix the problem in the longer term and to fix it appropriately and correctly. Or to be able to bug report it, maybe to the developers or whatever. And that then starts to bring about this whole kind of beta testing and so on and so forth that the open source community brings, which is a broader conversation.
Hey, you know what? This is interesting because last week I was at a Novell presentation where a guy was talking about Linux, and he had made a comment that with the 999 uptime, what people don't understand is you could have a 999 uptime, you could have a server that's running all the way, you know, running perfect nines, but they bring the server down to like a run level one and then bring it back up again to fix some issues. And that's, you know, still maintains their server uptime. And in some respects, I think, you know, he oversimplified the matter there and didn't give enough credit. But in other respects, I think that's true, too. You have the capability of being able to fine-tune and debug it and shut off processes and turn them back on again. So you don't have to have that significant uptime or downtime and reboot process with Windows.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course... furthermore, you just by doing simple run level adjustments, as you correctly say, you could. This is going to allow you to actually work on a live running system. Maybe you need to do some. Let's say you've got a scenario where you need to do some different configurations that are going to need to stop and restart some daemons, and you've really got to dig around in that system. You can do this work, much of it, actually on the fly whilst the system is still providing services to its users. Now, that's what we're really looking for, is the availability of the services that we're providing to the users. So if you've got to perform a reboot or a reload or something of this nature, this takes a lot of time. If you have to apply configurations, make some changes, drop a system to run level one and bring it back up to run level five again, this can be done. You know, you could be talking 30 seconds of outage and then back up online providing services to people, because you're able to work and manipulate the system whilst it's still running and providing services in 95% of cases.
Right. I have a few questions I want to ask you, but before I go down there, I want to clarify something in my mind. You had said that you were invited to be part of a Microsoft solutions provider group, a small Microsoft solutions provider group. Does your company provide Microsoft solutions?
No, is the quick and simple answer to that. No, we don't. Now, I take what is considered by some to be an almost religious stance here, but you know, you have to. You can't be a jack of all trades. You have to be able to specialize and work in a particular area. And just working in Linux and open source technology is an enormous field, absolutely huge. And there is no way that our company would be able to take more than 10% of that. In fact, I don't even think we reach in beyond 2 or 3%. We had to make a decision very early on about what we were going to do. And I made that decision as the managing director and the exec for the company in terms of its business strategy from the outset. And I'm going to be absolutely blunt here, Dan. You can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. And I'm afraid that the software, as far as I'm concerned, Microsoft software is broken out of the box. So if I deploy this, I'm going to have a problem. And we set out from the outset to say we are going to create satisfied customers by providing high-performance, reliable IT systems. We cannot do that utilizing Microsoft technologies. We just can't get the reliability out of them to be able to keep the customer happy. Something is always breaking, and this results in an unhappy customer. So we've said no. Now, we will help our clients, and we will work with their Microsoft desktops and their Microsoft solutions to configure them to integrate with Linux. But we don't support them, and for the very reason that I just stated, because it's broken out of the box. And we are we tend to be very open and honest about that, and in explaining how we see the position. So that's our position. We don't deploy any Microsoft technologies at all.
Oh, go ahead, Pat.
Rick, we have a similar saying here in the States. You can't shine a turd.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah. Yeah, it's okay. Mm.
So, you know, and it's good that Pat brought up the States, because in the States, there is a lot of support for Microsoft,
especially in the IT community and in the professional locations.
Now, you know, I don't get over to Europe much, and in fact, it's been about 10 years since I've been over there. But I get the impression that over in Europe and in England and Britain, that there is a significant movement over there to look at alternatives to Microsoft, be it Linux or BSD. Is that true? I mean, is there in your opinion, a larger movement? I mean, a significant movement to move away from Microsoft and look towards alternative or better choices?
The quick answer to that is no. Ultimately, what we all tend to see, I suppose, from a distant perspective, is we see what some of the major corporates or the blue chips are doing, and we'll see, stories like, well, the BBC delivers, you know, all of its teletext content using Linux servers and so on and so forth. And we, Reuters, the news channel, for example, have migrated everything to Linux. And this gives the impression that there are more companies that provide Linux and open source services. The reality of it is no, not at all. The IT industry in the UK, speaking for business in general, has a very poor record indeed. It you tend to find that when you speak to any business that has had an IT deployment, they have they've usually had relationships with many IT companies. The net result is that they work with an IT company for 6 months. They spend a reasonable amount of money, and they feel that they didn't get service, and they've got an unreliable system, and they move forward and move forward and move forward. And there are very few IT companies or technology companies that deliver business solutions that utilize or even recognize or often know of Linux and open source technologies. I mean, shockingly so. You would expect that any IT company, that even if they were delivering only exclusively Microsoft technologies, they would know about Linux, they would know about Unix, they'd know about BSD and the other flavors. Surely this is competent knowledge in a computing environment. I'm afraid not, gentlemen. The truth is that often they don't. Often they're just as blatantly never heard of it as anybody else. Many IT companies have backgrounds in, I don't know, graphic design, plumbing, carpentry, and they decide that they're going to have a career change and set up a new company, so they go and do an MCSE and an MCP, and off they go, and now they're computer network wizards because they can install Windows, and they go and start delivering services to businesses. And that's the situation. What you'll find, if you dig a little bit deeper into migrations like Hill House Hammond and the BBC and Supertramp, for example, you'll find that those migrations were actually conducted initially by the techies on the ground in the business. And it was those people on the ground, not an external IT company, that actually did the migration and deployed Linux. Often, they've deployed Linux and open source technologies without even the company knowing. The company thinks that they've got a Windows, you know, file server in the middle of it, a particularly reliable one, they tend to think. And what you actually find is that this is a Linux box running Samba.
Well, actually, I think it would be more or less they wouldn't notice that it's not that it's reliable, because they wouldn't give a damn at that point. Now, if it was unreliable, then they'd be pissed.
Well, exactly. And what you find is that is absolutely the truth. And if I take you back a moment to this mission statement that Adaptive has as a company, creating satisfied customers, you know, when everything works fine, you don't hear from your customers, just like the company with the almost 500 days uptime. We don't hear from them at all. If we go and ask them what they think, oh, they think everything's great, everything's fantastic, they're really happy. Of course, this is a satisfied customer. The only time that that changes is if the system becomes unreliable. And then, as you correctly say, then all of a sudden it's a thorn in their side. Then they're getting pissed, you know, and getting uptight with the situation, as you correctly point out.
So now your company is providing some really great open source and Linux solutions. What, in your mind, for businesses, and let's extend it a little further to just consumers too, because, you know, it's great to have it in the business, but it'd be great to have it on the home user's desktop too. What are the hurdles that Linux has to overcome yet, or what are the few roadblocks that they have to overcome so that it's going to be more widely accessible to the general user?
Okay. I'm going to try to put that question in a slightly different frame, because the frame that I generally see that question in is probably a piece of press or media that's banded about everywhere, which is that, you know, hey, when's Linux going to be ready for the desktop? You know, when will desktop Linux be ready to run in enterprise? And it's not quite there yet. You know, it needs a little bit more work and a little bit more polish. Poppycock is what I say to that. Back in 2000, so at the turn of the century, 6 years ago now, Supertramp, this was before Adaptive was formed, I was working as the technical director for a company called Supertramp Trampolines. And Supertramp provide garden play equipment and trampolines across the world, but predominantly in Europe and in the UK. And they're quite a large company. They spread their wings as far as they even ship products into the States, actually, as well. And we began investigating the possibility of utilizing Linux and open source technologies in 2000. And I went to the Linux World Expo on behalf of the company to investigate this, and had conversations with IBM and a very long conversation actually with John Terpstra from Caldera at the time. He was the CTO of Caldera, and he'd come from Australia in the Asian market. And when I put the question to him, which was, is Linux ready for the desktop? Can we use this in business? Can we set this up and use it as a business tool all the way to the desktop? His answer to me then was, absolutely, of course you can. In fact, we've already been doing that. We had a long discussion about the merits of Turbo Linux and so on and so forth. And we embarked upon a program then to migrate Supertramp. And we completed that as a total desktop migration in 2001. And those systems, some of the base systems are still in and running today, and some have been updated and various things. And When we look back to the question now, which is that, is Linux ready for the desktop? Then, yeah, absolutely it is. Is Linux ready for the home user to use? Then that's a slightly more difficult question. It's, I guess, all about competencies. Let's put this in two scenarios, okay? You have your home user now goes out and buys Windows XP and various bits of gizmos and gadgets to plug into it and so on and so forth. They take it home, plug it all in, and sure, it detects the camera and it detects the scanner and the TV card and the DVD and all of these things, and presents a little graphical interface. You bring it up on the internet, and a week later the thing's flat to the boards, full of viruses, and it's all broken and it doesn't work. And you spend ever increasing cycle now of trying to fix this thing, reloading software, and you find yourself with this unreliability. And I think often home users suffer with that quite a lot, because they are trying to do a very broad range of things with their machine, often where you know, much more so than you would be doing in a business environment. Now, the hurdle for the home user at the desktop is overcoming the, how do I install this? How do I get my hardware to work? How do I, you know, what happens when there's no drivers for this and so on and so forth? Well, you know, if you think about it, when you go to the PC shop, you don't buy a PC and then go and buy a bunch of disks, take it home and put the software on the disks and in the machine and load it up yourself and build it. That's not what happens. What happens is you buy it from the PC shop with all the software reloaded, and you buy hardware that says Windows compatible, Windows compatible. Now, if you do that, if the OEM providers, the manufacturers, would take a different stance from where they are at the moment, and I think there are many reasons why they don't do this, and certainly listening to your discussions with Jeremy Allison, he alluded to some of these. But they don't. But if you shipped a box with, say, Ubuntu loaded onto it, and the peripheral providers stamped works with Linux on the box, you could go into your PC shop and say, okay, I want to use a Linux box. So you buy your box. Now you don't run into how do I install the software. It's already done. So if you put it in a like-for-like scenario, then you buy Windows XP or you buy Linux, these troubles go away, because you're not having to install the software. So what you're left with now is two boxes that you switch on at home. The difference is going to be that when you switch your Linux box on, it's going to work, and it's going to work effectively, and it's going to work all of the time that you want to use it. This is not true of your XP box. And I think that's the hurdle. The hurdle is in the supply chain. It's not in the user base or whether the product is ready. Of course it's ready. Go and take a look at SUSE, Novell's Linux desktop. This is far beyond ready. I recently had the unfortunate experience of using Windows XP, and I've been using SUSE 10 up to that point, and it is a far superior desktop.
So, don't hold back, because I get the feeling you're not too pleased with Windows operating system.
Ultimately, no, I'm not. I guess I mean, let me give you a little bit of history, I suppose, in where I come from a technological point of view, that maybe gives me an advantage. My career started in IT when my actual official professional career started when I was 14. And I worked in Assembler to develop some audio sampling programs for a company called Datel here in the UK, and that supplied stuff to go with an old ZX Spectrum Micro. And I worked with IT then through the days of CPM and also then went into to take on board a professional career working for Mini systems and optical character recognition systems. And my career, I dropped out of working with IT at about the beginning of the kind of PC era. And I didn't come back into it for about 10 years. I went off to do some different things, investigate business and so on and so forth. And when I came back to IT, I got a PC, put sat down in front of it, got started to look at this stuff. And initially, I was quite impressed. I thought things had come really quite a long way. You know, I'd been used to doing things at the command line, and working with the spreadsheet involved a green screen and things like this. And this looked quite good. But what I found was that this stuff wasn't very reliable at all. It was certainly not as reliable as I expected it to be. And as that went on and moved forward, so as the progression moved forward through 95, 98, this reliability issue, this problem issue, seemed to get worse. And when I began my role at Supertramp, I was there working initially as the IT manager, and I found that I was running around from PC to PC to PC to server, fixing it, rebuilding it, reloading it, rebuilding it, running around, just following effectively software faults. And when I spoke to the application vendor, they told me it was the hardware. When I spoke to the hardware vendor, they told me it was the software. When I spoke to Microsoft, they said it's nothing to do with us. And I ran around in ever-decreasing circles. And when I took a step back from that and worked out the net cost, it was enormous. This, the support cost was just enormous. And I felt that there had to be another way. And obviously then looking at the original, what was originally Unix and the early VMS stuff, I discovered Linux and thought, okay, let's take a look at this. And this was a lot more what I was used to. So of course I was advantaged by that. I was given a tremendous advantage by that history, because of course I already knew this and experienced it, and I hadn't been Microsoftized, for want of a better word, if you like, and so therefore I had a deeper understanding of what really IT should be about. And and I have to say that I have found the Microsoft platform very dissatisfying, which shows poor reliability, and I find it very difficult to get on board with this concept that I'm going to pay for an operating system that's a little bit flaky, and I'm going to buy several applications at up to £500 a go that are equally a little bit flaky, and I'm not actually going to end up with a solution at the end of it. And then once I've run this stuff for 2 or 3 years, they're going to come back to me again and tell me I need to upgrade everything and reload it all. Oh, and by the way, while you're at it, you need to buy a whole bunch of hardware to run this new software on. Highway robbery comes to mind, I'm afraid.
Ain't that the truth? So now, in your general day-to-day use, what OS are you running? Obviously, I would suspect you're running Linux, and if you're running Linux, what distribution do you prefer?
I've got kind of different things, different distributions for different uses. So in my day-to-day work, so like my workstation here, for example, this runs Mandrake. And it runs Mandrake because it is very, it's a nice, simple OS to use. It has some good integration features. I like to do, I'm quite involved in one of my hobbies is music and audio stuff. And so I like to get involved in that. So I use things like Audacity, Rose Garden, Hydrogen, things like this for controlling a bunch of MIDI equipment here. And obviously then just general desktop tools. So this is quite good. I don't tend to do a great deal of systems administration from this machine, so I don't tend to need tools like Ethereal and Nessus, etc. I have a laptop that I use for development and diagnostic purposes, and I run Gentoo on that for the simple reason that I like the ability to just be able to emerge things out the Portage repositories and get the software that I need. And I find that that gives me a level of control that works really well. My office machine is a Fedora box, just purely and simply because I like to keep... I like to kind of keep an eye on what's happening there with the Red Hat stuff, because obviously it's all relating back to where the enterprise products are going, and that has some bearing on the business also. But in terms of which distribution do I favor?
Slackware, right?
Slackware's quite... Well, Slackware's pretty good, but I think I prefer Gentoo.
You're a masochist, huh?
You know, that seems to be the case with everybody. I guess it depends on whether you feel the need to rebuild your machine every week. If you need to rebuild your machine regularly, then Gentoo might not be the appropriate choice. But my laptop, I put Gentoo on it 2 years ago. And it's still the same installation. I just emerge, sync, update, run all the stuff, fiddle with it, and move it from there. And this works well. It's good.
And you use it once a week, right?
No, not at all. I mean, I use it I use it very regularly, often, pretty much daily.
Yeah, I've used Gentoo in the past, although I like Gentoo, I find it is a lot of upkeep. And do you ever... implement Gentoo solutions in businesses?
No, we have what are the, you know, what the way Adaptive has presented its business case is to we tried to make things very simple. So what we've done is we have created a range of products that we call Emperor. They're the Emperor products, and they you have got different things, mail servers, file servers, application servers, and so on and so forth. All of this is built on Debian Sarge, and we use Debian Sarge because of its stability and its reliability. Ultimately, when we're rolling things out for our clients, our goal as a company is to be able to phone our clients up 500, 600 days on and say, is everything okay? And then turn around and say, yes, it's all running fine. And we use Debian for that. We also have the desktop products that we've got. We use either Mandrake or SUSE. And that would be the Emperor Power Station and Emperor Workstations. These products are basically desktop machines for desktop computing. We use those two platforms because they provide very salient and user-friendly interfaces that users can get along with really well, whilst giving us some good administration tools to make them perform correctly in a business environment. And then we have we also use terminal servers and thin clients for our desktop deployments as well, because these have a whole host of advantages. And we use CentOS for that, which is Red Hat based, and that's implemented using the Linux Terminal Server project. On top of that Emperor infrastructure, then we're then able to layer applications. So and there'll be a whole host of those that we will apply for different things. So the answer to the question is predominantly Debian with some Red Hat CentOS stuff, SUSE and Mandrake for the workstations.
Rick, I want to thank you for staying up with us tonight. Really appreciate you, you know, staying up in the middle of the night, giving us your input and your thoughts on, you know, what you guys are doing. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
It's an absolute pleasure. Provided me with some provocative and interesting questions, and that's always a challenge that I enjoy.
Yeah, you know, keep up the great work over there. I mean, and you know, open some offices in the United States, particularly around the Lehigh Valley area in Pennsylvania.
We'll apply for you.
And that'll be 2000.
Well, we have an associate program, which allows effectively that the whole principle of this is to enable consultants and other businesses that are perhaps predominantly have Microsoft skills and want to be able to, gain a competitive advantage is the net result when competing for work elsewhere. And through this associate program, we're able to offer open source services. So, you know, maybe you guys want to consider taking on associate status in the States and doing something like that.
That's something we'll think about. That is definitely something we'll think about.
Rick, keep in touch.
Sure, absolutely. Be happy to.
Take care, right?
Yeah, okay, no problem. It's good to speak to you guys.
I hope you get some sleep tonight.
Yeah.
and you know, again, thank you for staying up. We really appreciate
it. No problem. It's been a pleasure. It's been very good speaking to you guys.
Good night.
Good night. All the best to you.
Yeah, we'll catch up with you again, man. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
All the best. Good night.
Take it easy.
Good night.
Bye. And that was Rick.
He's got some really great stuff going on over there. Wow. You know what? That's what I don't get. I mean, you got so much passion. You got so many... You get all this like wonderful stuff all over the world, and I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, you know, you got Lug Radio over there and they're doing Lug Radio live, and you got all this like every Linux format, Linux Developer Magazine, Linux Magazine, all this shit coming out of European market, SUSE, Mandriva now coming out of Europe, and you think that it's got to be, you know, it's got to be better. The Linux over there environment, the attitude has got to be better.
They probably have a bigger share of the market.
And you hear that, it's just not, you know, it doesn't seem to be much different than over here. And then we talk with Jess over in New Zealand, Australia. You hear all this shit is flying out the door over in Australia with regards to Linux. And you're talking to people and it's like, it doesn't seem to be much better. What's it going to take? You hear all this, you hear like China and India, people are saying, oh, it's just huge over there, and it sounds like it's so big.
Well, the reason why those places
over there, are they going to say, well, you know, it's not that big?
The reason why those places it's big is because those people don't have the money to pay frickin' Microsoft. In the United States, North America, Europe, the money's there. They're willing to pay to shell out the cash for Microsoft. You know, they're crap products. You know, it's like that saying: nobody's ever been fired for suggesting, you know, to use Microsoft.
They should have been.
Yes,
I agree, man.
I agree. They should have been.
That sucks. That sucks. And you know what? And it's always the same argument you hear. There's
it. It's the same crap.
Two or three applications.
It's too hard to install. It's too hard to administer. This doesn't run on it. You know. Dan, you got to finish that video of your daughter installing Ubuntu, man, so I can whip out that video and show the asshole Windows administrators how hard it is.
But that's the thing, you know. If you install Windows, it's a nightmare. It's not any harder.
It's getting better. I mean,
what, installing Windows?
No, they are starting to sell more Linux boxes, different companies. There's an article that Sandros is going to be selling Linux boxes in CompUSA, which is a huge chain here in the United States. You also hear about the work that Linspire is doing, getting into more stores. They're selling their boxes at Fry's and some of the online stores like Tiger Direct or Newegg. I mean, it's getting there slowly, and then you hear, you know, Dell is coming around again to start selling Linux boxes. Granted, they're not targeting the home desktop user. You're targeting more of the scientific power workstation user. But it's little steps, you know. You know, we do what we can. We try to get our friends and family to try it out, you know, see what it's all about. Your machine runs better. There's less problems. You don't get spyware. You don't get viruses. You know, we just got to keep on bantering people and pushing this, you know, this whole concept, you know, as much as we can. It's not an easy battle, but we got to do it.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you.
I'm down for organizing some kind of a protest thing when if they have a Vista release party. You know, like back when Windows 98 came out, they had all these events, you know, all around the country where they would, you know, all around the world, actually, where they would have, you know, midnight release party where they, you know, you see a bunch of people waiting at the doors waiting to get in so they can go rush in and buy their Windows 98 copy. You know what, man? Let's get a fucking busload of people. Let's show up at this freaking goddamn place. Let's call the press, and let's get some freaking action going, man. You know, let's step it up, you know?
I still get it. Oof. Got a long way to go yet.
Don't you think that would be great if we if there was like a Windows release party and we showed up with like two busloads of people and we all came out and we started handing out Linux CDs and talking to the press and, you know, generating interest, man. You got to do shit like that, you know? You look on TV and say, oh, what the fuck are these people doing protesting? What the fuck is that? You know what? You got to get your ass out there, and you got to freaking let it all hang out, man.
Linux, Vista
sucks.
What if they get it right? What if Vista comes out and it's like, "Whew, you don't need antivirus anymore. We got it right."
Yeah,
what
right.
Yeah,
you
right.
Believe it. Don't hold your breath, Dan.
What if? I don't know. What if?
Hey, man, I'm down for organizing something. Let's find out what the plans are going to be for the quote unquote. You know, they say they're going to release Vista in November, man. We'll see if they do it in November. Let's find out what the release plans are. How much press they're going to generate? You know, we'll find out. And I think we should try to organize some kind of a thing where we show up in mass. I think that'll really at least get some press generated. You know.
I hear what you're saying. What about, speaking of organizing shit, where are we at with the LWE? I mean, we're on. We got an email about furniture.
Did you see the fucking price?
Oh my god! Yeah,
they're like charging like $300 for a couple of bar stools to rent out some bar stools.
Yeah. What do we get with our? Are we going to be laying on the floor?
No, I think we get like two stools and a table.
I was planning on bringing some folding chairs, man. Those union assholes show up, man, I'm going to fucking walk right by them.
Well, no, the one guy that emailed us said, you know, pretty much if you carry it in on your own, you're not going to have too much problems. So, like, backpack type things. I got those little chairs that, you know, like, just fit in a bag type things.
So I know that, and I noticed they were talking about it. You could get carpeting, and you could also get padding under the carpeting. Because I know, I mean, wear really comfortable shoes. Because when you stand around all day on that floor, and it really kills your feet. But
cement isn't all that.
No,
great
it's not.
To stand on.
It's not.
Dan'll sleep on it.
Yeah,
Dan's gonna move into the cubicle, and he's just gonna crash there.
Yeah, it'll be little duty piles later out there in the morning. We'll sell it. Memorabilia.
Yeah, we have a tax stamp now.
Yeah.
Yeah, what are the things that they made us do if we're going to sell anything? We had to go out and get a seller tax ID from the state of Massachusetts. It wasn't too difficult. You just go on the website and you register. So we did that. We got to display the registration ID in the cubicle.
Where's the login? Pat didn't pay for it yet. As soon as Pat gets our adult verification at adultbouncer.com,
start downloading.
We'll be able to download the porn.
That's a good site, man.
You know. Speaking of that, this is an interesting thing. My eBay account that I signed up for, my wife had an eBay account prior to before mine, and she was selling stuff on eBay for a little bit, but then she stopped. I went and I made an eBay account. Not an eBay, PayPal account, I'm sorry. And when I tried to verify it using my checking account, it wouldn't let me do it. Because she had already verified it. So
Carolyn has stuff, and it's all screwed up.
And they want you to, like, fax, like, your something.
It's almost impossible to cancel that account without having, like,
right.
Fax. You got to fax this shit in, and then, you know, we didn't get it, and... It's easier just to create another one.
Yeah, I found a way around it.
Yeah, use a different email address and a different name.
It is a different email address and a different name, but it won't let me use my account, my checking account, because it's the same checking account that she had.
Oh, okay.
But I know so that's we use the savings account instead. I just use the savings account. What's the difference? Because they're pricks, man. They charge you. They charge you a lot of money for transfers. If you want them to send you a check, it takes 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So we have that $75 that we got as a donation. Which
that was cool, man.
And then I got the...
What was that, chess?
Yeah, I think so. And then I got the payment for the article, which I got to dump out.
Everybody who's donated money to us for the Linux World Expo, man, we really appreciate you guys helping us out, man. It really means a lot to us. Thank you.
When is that article coming out? Did they give you a date on it?
It's the May edition.
Cool.
Which would mean...
So which magazine is this, Dan?
Linux Magazine.
This is Linux Magazine International.
Right.
Not Linux Magazine United States.
No.
In the United States, it's called Linux Pro, right?
Is it Linux Pro and Developer, I think? Awkward silence.
Pregnant pause.
It's the Linux developer, Linux user and developer, I believe it is. Linux user and developer. But yeah, we got to start marketing, you know, more shit out there. The more stuff we get out, it's
I'm down money. For writing articles. I'm actually thinking about writing an article about Bluetooth stuff in Linux.
Do that.
You know, a few months ago, I talked a little about the KDE Bluetooth framework. I'm going to check out the GNOME stuff and see how it compares, and maybe I'll do a write-up and see if I can get it published somewhere. No, a lot of people are interested in that stuff, so it should be good. We can always talk about multimedia stuff, too.
Yeah. Woo! You know, someone recommended me caffeine to use as a front end to a zine, And I tried using
I recommend
using
caffeine
it.
On a regular basis.
I tried using it.
I like it,
it
in the mornings, man.
And it just, it's, for some reason on the arch, it didn't work out for me. Everything I tried to open up just wouldn't open up. So I'm still, you know, Zine and VLC and M-Player for me.
I pretty much the same deal. VLCs, I use it a lot. You know, on my piece of shit Windows box at work, I use VLC.
I like VLC.
M-Player's good design with DVD.
I like M-Player. I don't like G-Zine.
No, I don't either.
We talked about that last week. Yeah. I do believe I pulled down the file that you wanted me to play, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And I don't know where. Oh, the Cyan Velvet Project?
Cayenne Velvet Project.
Cayenne. Cayenne Velvet Project.
This is pretty rocking, man. This is a Finnish band. They're kind of like modern industrial metal kind of sound. It's pretty good stuff. This song is pretty short. It's called, Over the Noise of, Over the Noise of the Living. So next week we're going to talk to Dirk Hondell from Intel. That should be a good interview. And we're getting more preparations ready for Linux World Expo in Boston. We hope to see you guys there. You know, for those of you who can't make it, you know, hopefully we can meet up at some point in the future. Those of you who are coming, man, let's party.
All right.
You have to be just a little more quieter into the mic. You're blowing my ears out.
Who?
Pat.
Pat.
He's like getting so passionate. Here,
I'll turn down your headphones.
No. Then I can't hear Dan, but.
You know what? Speaking of Linux podcasts, I still have to add those too. There is another one I saw out there, and I'm trying to remember what it was. Was it The Cult of Linux or Linux Cult? There's another podcast out there that I stumbled upon it, and I can't remember why I stumbled upon it.
Speaking of podcasts, did you ever get around to adding those other shows onto our list?
I just said that I got to add those two shows yet.
also, I'm sorry. Not that I'm not paying attention to you. You guys notice on DistroWatch, you're listening to the Linux podcast?
Yes.
On the front page? That's very cool, those guys. A lot of Sluff and Crew, thank you for doing that, man. That's a really cool way to generate some interest in the shows.
Yes, it is. And hopefully very soon there'll be a new Linux podcast coming out.
Linux Gamer?
Logger. Hopefully. I'm planning on having an episode out within the week.
Well, good luck with that, man.
Yeah. Alan?
No, I'm pretty much done for the night here.
Alan is spent.
Like a cheap whore. Alan is spent.
I'm anything but cheap.
No, he's really cheap. Hey, we got 5 minutes.
How about some Frapper shout-outs, man?
Go do some Frapper shout-outs.
Give me a second here to pull up the page.
And there goes our bandwidth.
It's linuxcult.com has a podcast.
I've never heard of it.
Where
are they from?
Linuxcult.com? I don't know. They're on episode 6, though, and I want to add them, and I want to listen to their podcast. I don't know if they have an RSS feed, though. I don't see one here offhand, but check them out.
I'm just killing the bandwidth loading up Frapper.
All right.
You know what I've been getting into lately, man? I've been really getting into BinRev lately. Good stuff from those guys, man. Okay, let's see. Who do we got? Here go Frapper shoutouts. We got Corey in Melrose Park, Illinois. We got Chad in Fresno, California. We've got Anthony in Astoria, New York. We got Robbie Shop in Hugo, Minnesota. Jason Tokars in Warrington, England. We've got Yure Repnik from Bohichka, Bystrica. I probably butchered that. What else we got? We got FDA.KHVA0 from Rivne, Ukraine. We got Ricerage from Bowling Green, Kentucky. We got Jaris from Copenhagen, Denmark. We've got Kate from Seattle, Washington. We got Ricardo Texera from From Villa de Conde, Norte, Portugal, we got John from West Lafayette, Indiana. We've got Zorantu from Kansas City, Kansas. We got Iceman from Ringstad, Denmark. Dan Gilliam from Richmond, Virginia. Sam from Spencerport, New York. We got Bart Silverstrom from Towanda, Pennsylvania. And we got Ma from Derry, New Hampshire. And that's it. We got a lot of Danish listeners, man. Props to Denmark, man. You guys are awesome. Thanks for listening. Ireland, where the heck are you guys, man? Someone from Ireland. Put a post on our Frapper map, man. Let us know you guys are alive. We got everywhere else. And we don't have any Russian postings on there either. So,
what is that video cast called?
Off the top of my head, I can't remember it.
The Source Show?
Open Source?
I gotta get off my ass.
Yes, Dan, get off your ass, man. It's been a couple weeks already.
Yeah, no, it's only been a week.
No, it's been a couple weeks.
It's only been a week.
For the video cast.
Play us out.
Alrighty, everybody. That was episode 127. We'll see you next week.
Alright! Maybe Link will actually show his face.
Maybe.
Wait, who's our guest for next week? Is that the Patton?
Dirk Hondell.
Patton?
No, Dirk Hondell from Intel.
And then?
Then the week after that, we got the guy from the Patton attorney.
Okay, cool. Alright. This is, who is this, Pat?
The Kai and Velva Project from Finland.
And how do we have them?
I saw them on GarageBand.
Okay. Great. Alright, here we go. Good Thank stuff. You for listening. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everybody.
Good night.
Your fine ass. Yeah, with my tongue brush. Shut up. Just shut up. It's over.